Folks, you know, I am all about those little pick-me-ups throughout the day. Whether it's tackling work tasks or conquering chores around the house, treating myself is a must. And you know what gets me smiling every time? Japanese snacks. Not only are they bursting with flavor, but their cute packaging and quirky vibes add an extra layer of fun. That is why teaming up with Boxu, a Japanese snack subscription box, has been such an absolute delight, because these are not just your run-of-the-mill grocery store snacks. Each month, Boxu brings you over 20 unique treats that you can normally find only in Japan. Plus, they throw in a nifty guide packed with info about each snack and Japanese culture. Snacking while learning? Are you kidding? It's like this was literally made for me. Oh, and each box ships free from Japan straight to your door. I happen to have a box right here, and let me tell you something. I loved the first box they sent so much, I told our ad people, please make sure that Boxu re-ups, because I gotta get another box of these snacks. First of all, check out this incredible guide here full of beautiful photos. It tells you about all the different snacks. You know, my girlfriend's gluten-free, so we can find one in here that makes sure it works for her dietary restrictions. But she's not here right now, so I'm going to make sure I eat one of the gluten-y ones. Ooh, 20th century pear biscuit. This delicate biscuit is a luxurious blend of 20th century Asian pear, rich cheese, and decadent white chocolate. Oh, it contains wheat, so that means I should eat it. All right, let me find it here. 20th century pear biscuit. Okay, here we go. Found it. 20th century pear biscuit. Cute little packaging. Let me give it a try. Oh my gosh. That is so good. Oh, the pear flavor is really strong. It's like a strong aroma. Next to this crunchy biscuit, the textural contrast is really wonderful. I mean, that is so good. And guess what? There are 19 other different snacks in here for me to try. I love this service so much. And you know why? My favorite thing about it is that they support small family-run businesses in Japan. Boxu has sourced these treats by working with over 245 small makers in Japan, helping out their businesses and helping to preserve their traditions. So if you love Japanese snacks as much as I do, and if you want to try snacks that you literally cannot get anywhere else outside of going to Japan yourself, you have got to try out Boxu. Right now, you can use the code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. Tell them Adam sent you, and now I got to finish these snacks. Oh man, that's really good. I'm glad she's gluten-free so I could eat this one.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
I don't know the truth!
Hello and welcome to Factually. I'm Adam Conover. Thank you for joining me once again as I talk to an amazing expert about all the amazing stuff they know that I don't know and that you probably don't know. We together are going to try to pry all that delicious knowledge meat out of their skulls and cram it into our own. That's what we're doing on this show. But first, I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible by supporting our Patreon. If you want to join them, head to patreon.com/Adam Conover, where you can get bonus podcast episodes, stand-up that I don't post anywhere else, and you can join our live book club where we read a recent nonfiction book together and discuss it. It's an awesome community. You can join us at patreon.com/Adam Conover. But hey, the podcast itself is still free. You don't don't got to subscribe at all to listen to this episode. So let's talk about what we are talking about on the show today. Today, we're talking about shit. You know, poop, caca, fecal matter. See, when we're pondering the great accomplishments of humankind, we don't usually think about poop. And yet, poop is the stuff that comes out of all of our butts. Your butt, my butt, and a great chain of butts stretching back hundreds of thousands of years. It's one of the most basic parts of humanity. In many ways, we are nothing but machines that turn food into poop. But this very basic part of ourselves is something that we prefer to basically never think about. Like, we literally pipe clean water into all of our houses, and we use that clean water not for drinking, not for showering, but just for moving our poop out of our houses as quickly as possible. Just, we want to be able to drop that deuce, hit that flush, and have it be gone in an instant. But the problem is, that desire to not think about poop, to eliminate it from human life, is impossible. Because poop is a part of who we are in more ways than one, or more ways than two. Does that joke even make sense? Do you get that? Whatever. We'll move on. You simply cannot manage lots of people living together without managing their poo. And so the history of urbanization and hence civilization required humans to master shit, or at least master its management. The earliest sewage system, essentially septic pits, appears in one of the earliest cities, Babylon, around 4000 BCE. Then, some geniuses in Mohenjo-Daro in modern-day Pakistan realized you could connect latrines directly into a sewage system. The Romans ended up monumentalizing this concept and called it, this is true, the Cloaca Maxima, which features a series of 11-foot-high stone vaults. It's literally a cathedral to crap. Our ancestors had to build enormous works of engineering just to manage our shit, because shit matters. Waste management is a huge factor in the modern era's increase in life expectancy. Before we were able to get rid of our shit effectively, a lot of people died of cholera and other diseases. And more recently, we're even beginning to learn about ways that shit can be useful to us. Wastewater epidemiology, for instance, is a recent and growing field that has been used during the pandemic to get a sense of where outbreaks are happening without needing to rely on individual test results. Now, that's just one example of the way that our waste can be used to make our lives better. But there are a lot more. And to discuss them on the show today, we have the perfect guest. Lena Zeldovich is an incredibly smart science journalist, and she's the author of the new book, The Other Dark Matter: The Science and Business of Turning Waste into Wealth and Health. Please welcome Lena Zeldovich. Lena, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for inviting me. Great to be
here. You have a new book out that is all about shit. Let's just get it out of the way and let's just say that it's about shit. Is that okay, or is that derogatory for me to put it that way?
No, it's completely okay. I think shit is an awesome substance, and that's exactly what I'm going to talk about today.
You think it's an awesome substance. I love it. So this is right up my alley. Please tell me, why is it an awesome substance, and why did you write this book? How did you come to write it?
Sure. Why is it an awesome substance? Because it is such an incredibly versatile resource and fully renewable, by the way, because there's 7 people on this planet and we all produce it pretty regularly. Well, most of us anyway. Why is it so versatile? Because you can do almost anything with it, as we're going to talk later in this conversation. For starters, it's an incredible fertilizer. It's best fertilizer out there. It can also be converted into a form of crude oil, so all kinds of energy that can be extracted from it, and even medicine. Mm.
7 billion people shitting all the time. But here's the thing. I know that, like, for instance, you know, manure, animal manure is used in compost. I have that sense, right?
Yes.
And I've always wondered, wait, hold on a second. Could my shit be used as compost and, or, you know, as fertilizer? I'm like, but I don't know anyone who uses it for that purpose. Maybe there's some reason that human shit can't be used that way. Can it really? And is it just that we happen not to do it most of the time?
Not only it can be used that way, but it should be used that way. It is actually better than cow manure or chicken poop or any other manure. And here is why. Of all the animals out there on Earth, humans are the ones with the most diverse diets. What we produce and put out is actually full of all kinds of nutrients that, let's say, a cow wouldn't have. And that is why it actually makes best fertilizer. Why we don't use it that way? Well, there are certain reasons to it, and I think we're going to get into them a little later. But generally, It's the culture. Our culture does not consider it a valuable resource and, you know, a proper way of fertilizing crops. Many societies before us were had a completely opposing view of their waste. They didn't consider it waste. They considered it fertilizer, and they used it. We're just kind of rediscovering their wisdom now.
Yeah, I mean, our relationship, at least here in the U.S. where I am now, with poop is like, get it away from me as fast as possible. Like I poop in a little white bowl that I keep very clean, and then I push the button, and it makes a big noise, and whoosh, it goes far away. And it leaves my house almost immediately and is like taken away in pipes, you know? It's like, this shit is radioactive, it's shameful, it's harmful, get it out. Right. And that's how I've grown up. That's how what I've always been surrounded by. Is that part of what's going on? And is that a way of thinking about shit that we should try to change?
That's how we think about shit for the most part. And yes, this is what we should change. It's sort of, we inherited this view. Well, I can say that we developed this view in the 19th and 20th century because science was discovering how many different types of pathogens can be in that little pile of poo that humans produce. I should mention, it's not there immediately, but left outside in its own devices, it will immediately become very tasty dinner to all kinds of, you know, pathogens, larvae, flies, all kinds of stuff. So, of course, it's going to become, you know, radioactive. Of course, it's going to become extremely pathogenic. Of course, it's going to become really dangerous. But we're not talking about leaving it out there to its own devices. We're talking about processing it in a different way rather than annihilating, putting it to good use.
Well, and I'm also thinking about how you said the 19th century, and this was a time when people started really congregating in cities, like, you know, especially if you think about the image of 19th century London, you know, there's just shit everywhere. There's like horse shit, people shit, dog shit, and people get sick as a result, like because they don't have adequate sewage systems. And so there's just sort of shit in people's water and they're getting like, this is like the source of like cholera and stuff like that, right?
Yes.
Those sorts of diseases. So it makes sense that then people would say, okay, there's lots of people dying. We got to figure out a way to get the shit far, far away because when it sits around, it's very bad for us. But that's a technological solution that maybe is a little bit less nurturing than what we could do with it, I suppose.
Yeah, no, you're completely right. And I really like how you picked up on the fact that it really became a problem when people started aggregating in cities, because for as long as we were nomadic, we could just take a dump wherever and just walk away from our shit and it never bothered us. And it was, if you think about it, quite liberating. And then people started settling
down. Oh, the freedom
down. Exactly.
When you go camping and you're like, you know what? Let me pee in the woods.
Exactly.
Let me poop in the woods, but be good about it and bury it or whatever you do. You know, you have good camping hygiene, as I hope you all do. But it is very liberating because you're like, oh, it's just part of nature. It's not that big a deal. All the animals shit in the woods and I'm one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. You're giving it back to Mother Nature as it should be. But when people started living in cities, shit really hit the fan. That's like one of my favorite statements. Because you could no longer walk away from it. I mean, if you had a little village, you could probably like wander off, you know, to the left, to the right and whatever. But imagine 19th century London. Where would you go? There were houses everywhere and piles of shit everywhere. And that was a real, real problem. What I found really interesting is it's actually our modern sewage infrastructure kind of originated in London of that time. In fact, the first person who built a prototype of the toilet that we use today was an Englishman. His name was Sir John Harrington. He was Queen Elizabeth's cousin who got sent into exile from the court for whatever, but some poem he wrote that she didn't like. And while in that exile, exactly, had nothing to do, so he busied with himself with building the first water closet, the first flushing toilet. Kind of primitive, but, you know, a bunch of pipes, you know, a place to sit. And the queen came and visited him, and she liked it, so she wanted one at her house. And then all the, you know, nobility of the time decided they wanted it too. Took a while to catch up. There was also a British engineer, His name was Thomas Crapper. Yes, that's mm-hmm. where that name comes
the
from.
Very famous, the very famous anecdote about, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
tell me about him.
Yeah, so he kind of got that original primitive toilet into this nice flushing apparatus that we have today. Almost, not quite what we have today, but close enough. It didn't stink anymore. You know, it flushed nicely. The water came in and out. And then everybody wanted it because mm-hmm. all this, you know, rich and important people could now act not as if their shit didn't stink, but as if they didn't produce it. They would disappear mm-hmm. into their water closets and come out. There was nothing left behind for their servants to take out. Wow. You know, we have arrived. Now, that also caused problems because all that shit had to go someplace. And where did it go? Right. Ultimately, into the river. Into this gorgeous, beautiful river that got so polluted that it caused the great stink of London, actually, even more yeah. than once. And this is basically the infrastructure we inherited. We inherited the form of dealing with our excrement is by flushing it down the toilet, down the pipe, and somewhere. And in the next 100 years, we perfected what we did to it. Basically, destroy it as efficiently as possible. And just, yeah. you know, like dump it somewhere, just like out of sight, out of mind, pretend we don't do it.
Yeah, we go to, I remember when I lived in New York, I lived in a neighborhood called Greenpoint, right by a sewage treatment plant.
Yes.
And they had these big digester eggs, and they would do tours. I never got to go on one of the tours, and I still want to. The Newton Creek wastewater treatment plant.
Yes.
That is where they process like a huge amount of poop in New York, and they digest it down. And then I don't know what happens to it. Like once it's digested, it's, I guess it's not poop anymore. It's broken down. And then it's, I guess, flushed into the ocean? Question mark?
No, it's actually not that bad at all. It's actually one of the better treatment plants. And by the way,
Oh, you know this one?
Of course, I did go on a tour. There's a whole chapter about this plant in my book. It's actually mind-boggling. It's actually really, really cool. So no, it's not flushed anywhere. What they do with it, there's so much, New York produces so much shit that there's really no way.
The number one, New York City, number one in shit. All right. Number one, you go see a Broadway show, you get some nice pizza, you take the best shit of your life. That's what you do when you go to New York, New York City, number one.
Yeah, exactly. So there's actually no good way to get rid of it. Ideally, if we weren't so big, we actually could convert that digested product, new product that comes out of the digesters that you mentioned. It's basically, essentially compost. It's composted poo. It's just about soil. So if there was a farm nearby, it could go straight in that farm, be mixed with the regular soil, and we could grow food with it. It's just too much. So you have to truck it out. God knows where. Like you don't have enough farms to absorb all this. So they always kind of struggle with it. For now, a lot of it is landfill, they told me, which means it just goes and joins other garbage in a landfill where it just sort of covers it. It's still better than dumping it in the ocean. It still becomes kind of soil as everything else decomposes there. But there could be better ways. It just, you know, it takes infrastructure, planning, a lot of organizing.
Wow. I had no idea that it actually ended up in a landfill. But yeah, that would be a really hard thing to figure out. Like, okay, even if you had the good shit that you could distribute and use as compost, like how would you get it? There's farms upstate and whatnot, but there's not enough for like 8 million people, each of them taking hopefully a shit a day, which would be healthy. You know, probably some of them wait a week or so that and have because they've got problems, but they should go talk to their doctor about that. So how did you end up writing about this?
That is a great question and kind of an interesting one. So I had a very unconventional upbringing. I grew up in Russia in my grandfather's farm. And my grandfather, who had 2 degrees, one in agriculture and one in engineering, fertilized our farm with the contents of our septic tank that we produced. He did it regularly once a year. There were a couple of very valid reasons why he did so. Generally, the more self-sufficient you were in the former Soviet Union, the better it was, because you never knew what the government would do in general or to you specifically. My family was Jewish. The more self-reliant we could be, the better it was. He had this little plot of land that he got from a plane factory where he worked, and he turned it into a farm. And so the way he did it was he would open the septic tank about once a year, like usually in the fall when everything was sort of quieting down for winter, nothing would grow, meaning nothing could really get contaminated, like no produce. And then he would distribute it somewhere on the farm, underneath the trees, and into his compost pits. He had about three of them, and they were rotating. So he would dump a bunch of sewage into one and close it for like 2 years and use others. And when he would open it again, 2 years down the road, there was no sewage left. Nothing. It was just like rich black dirt and a lot of earthworms.
Wow.
Chewing through it. And that dirt was gold. It was soft and fluffy like powdered sugar. And plants loved it, and they grew so well with it.
Wow. That's a beautiful image, because I'm imagining, as you're telling me this guy shoveling human sewage, right? Probably very stinky. Mm-hmm. Maybe we would think of that as being very vile, radioactive stuff. But when he opens it 2 years later, I can picture, oh, that really good soil. Like the kind of, like sometimes you see soil that's so good that you're like, ooh, it's making me a little bit hungry almost, because you can tell it's so nutritious.
Exactly.
And that's what I'm picturing.
Exactly.
And that transformation of something that we think of as being very disgusting to something that we think of as being very nutritious, that's going to start the cycle of nutrition again.
Yes.
That's a very beautiful image.
Yes.
Is that really what he would do? And then he would spread it out on his farm and grow food for you with it.
What was interesting is, it was stinky, but it never really bothered us so much. You know, sometimes coming home from school, I could tell that that's what Grandpa was doing, because you could smell like a mile away, if not more. It was just kind of like, you know, permeating through the air. But you would get used to it so quickly, because it was a normal smell. You know, it was the part of life. And when you open the pit, oh God, that smell was incredible. It smelled of nature, of spring and the promise of the next harvest. It was just so good. Like I wanted to dig my hands into it and smell it.
Wow. Yeah. And you never felt like, hey, I'm eating my own shit.
No.
You know?
No, never? I never felt that way. In fact, what he used to say was, you have to feed the earth the way you feed people. And so to me, it was such a beautiful concept. It was that cycle of nature that now we all talk about, circular agriculture, circular economy. That's what it was. And it continued. You know, I don't even remember how many years he owned that farm, but 30 at least, maybe more. And it just kept going. It never grew barren, because we fed the earth with our own metabolic product.
How did he learn to do this? Was this a thing other people were doing, or was he sort of a weird guy with some old books who like, I've learned how to turn my shit into gold?
I think there was a certain truth to that. I don't know where he learned this, because it never occurred for me to ask him, but I knew that other people didn't necessarily do it. I think he was, to an extent, an outlier. I think some people did do it and others didn't. He definitely had his own special methods when it came to agriculture. I wonder now, years later, I wonder if he learned it, you know, from if this idea sort of came from the East, from China and Japan, because there farmers have been doing it for generation and generation,
really?
You know, going back, 100 years.
Is this sort of reuse of human feces, like, still, is this practiced regularly elsewhere around the world?
I don't really think so. I haven't really found a lot. When I was researching the book, I didn't find a lot of it. I think in some places it might, but I don't think it's really like a widespread, you know, practice. I think people tend to rely on, you know, animal manure more than anything, and also on birds' droppings. They are also quite, you know, make good fertilizer. Yeah. I don't know why it's not it's not done in other places of the world. I think, again, part of it is that we're so convinced that this just such an it's an epitome of waste. It's like you said, it's radioactive.
Yeah. But it seems very unusual, even just under capitalism, to waste something that could be a valuable resource. You know, like if you take anything and, you know, throw it in the recycling bin or whatever, someone is going to find some reuse for it, right? Might not be a great use, but there's, you know, the market as it is tends to, you know, figure out how to reuse something, right? How, like, okay, I can buy this real cheap and I can extract the precious metals from it or whatever, that kind of thing. And so it seems very odd that, you know, you'd have, say, a wastewater treatment plant like the one we were talking about, generating huge amounts of this stuff that could be useful, but not actually making use of it, like, anywhere around the world. I mean, is it that there's so much animal manure that there's no need for human manure in no. farming and in for fertilizer?
No, not at all. It's actually a lot more complex, much more complex dilemma. So for starters, most people don't want anything to do with shit. Theirs or anybody else's. You just pull the flush, yeah. Right? We're conditioned. The medicine of the 20th century, you know, told us to stay away from it as far as possible. The other thing that happened in the early 20th century is that people basically learned to make fertilizer from the thin air, that nitrogen that all plants need to grow. Mm-hmm. The two German engineers developed, you know, the specific process called Haber-Bosch process that is extremely polluting, takes insane amount of fossil fuels, spits out those really bad gases that contribute to acid rains, like really, really bad industrial process. But it makes nitrogen, and it makes as much nitrogen as you want. And nitrogen doesn't stink like shit does. It packages very neatly into bags, and it doesn't leak.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Nothing bad happens to it en route, and you can just ship it anywhere you want and put it into the soil. And the plants will love it. They will take it up and grow. They're just not going to grow as nutritious because just nitrogen or, you know, just phosphorus, it's another fertilizer. It doesn't produce fruit and vegetables as tasty as normal soil, well-balanced soil that has all kinds of other things in it. But it's easy.
Yeah. So the problem is that we have a very sort of high-tech shortcut to get pure nitrogen, pure fertilizer that we manufacture at great expense when we are literally shitting something better out of our backsides. But the problem with what's coming out of us is that it's stinky, we have a cultural aversion to using it, and there's a distribution problem, like you said earlier, that we, you know, you've got the wastewater treatment plant, they've got this stuff sitting around in barrels, or however they have it, in pipes, and, well, how are they going to get it to Bakersfield, California, where there's a whole lot of farming going on? Or how are they going to get it to Mexico, where there's a lot of farming going on? Like, are you going to truck shit across the world? Are you going to build a shit pipeline? What are you going to do? So as a result, we end up just using the shortcut, which is more harmful.
Exactly. And we over-fertilizing the ocean with, not without sewage per se, but with the sewage effluent, because the water still has to go somewhere, right? We clean the water at the wastewater treatment plant, and then out it flows. We clean it from pathogens. We don't clean it from nitrogen. We don't clean it from phosphorus. So all this stuff flows into our waterways and ultimately into the ocean, where it fertilizes all the wrong things, like algae, like that algae that grows that we don't want to grow, but we keep fertilizing it.
Yeah. Algal blooms are a huge problem in the ocean, where there's like a source of fertilizer, and then you get this huge bloom of algae that grows up, and then that like chokes out sunlight, and then you've got invasive species, well, not invasive species, but you have certain opportunistic species eating all the algae and choking out other species. It's like a big problem in ecosystems, algal blooms. So we are literally, instead of making use of all this fertilizer that we are naturally producing out of our own butts, we are just fertilizing the ocean instead and causing problems rather than fertilizing our own farms.
Yeah, you got it. You got it. And I really like how you say fertilizers out of our own butts, because the Japanese farmers about 200 years ago said exactly that. They had a special term for their poop. They called it shimagoye, which meant fertilizer from the bottom of a person. And they collected it meticulously from their cities in by way of buckets and carried their buckets to their little boats and then sailed these boats to the countryside where farmers bought it. Farmers bought shit. Okay, you see the difference?
Wow.
Here,
yeah.
We paid to take it away. There, they paid to buy it.
Yeah, I mean, if you were hard up for money, it would be really great to be able to sell your shit, I think. Like, you could sell your blood, right? Why not
but
sell
no
your shit?
Shit, exactly.
At the very least, you know, I hate, see, this is what this is triggering for me. Because I hate throwing anything away. You know, I at the very least, if I find something in my house, I'm like, I want to put it on eBay and at least get a couple bucks. But more importantly, I want to know that someone else is going to make use of it. I don't want it to go to a landfill. I ideally want to help someone else reuse it. And now I feel that way about my own shit, that I'm like, I'm wasting something that is perhaps valuable. So let me ask this. I grew up in a gardening household. My parents gardened. They still do. I live in a city townhome. I don't have a garden myself. I have a couple boxes on my roof that I've been thinking about putting some like peppers and stuff in. Maybe next year I'll start my urban gardening adventure. Is this something that's possible for me to do? Is there a way for the folks listening at home to take their own shit and turn it into fertilizer? Or is that not something you suggest that amateurs try to do in a city where maybe your neighbors can smell you?
Well, that's the great question. Yes, if you have 4 acres of land, you can designate a compost pile where you can probably dump that as long as it doesn't put you at odds with whatever municipal rules there are.
We had a compost pile in my house growing up. We did not put our own shit in it, but we put all of our vegetable leavings and like leaves and stuff like that.
Same.
Just a big pile in the back. And it was so cool. It gets all hot from the reactions of the pathogen or the bacteria, like chewing up the food. And then it it was just a very cool thing to see as a kid. But if you just put human shit in that kind of compost pile, would it work or no?
You'd have to mix it really well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And cover with something, I mean, like hay or whatever, because it will stink.
Yeah.
I would not recommend it in any city. I live in New York City. I have like a regular compost pile in my backyard where all the leaves go, but no, I'm not going to mess with anything else because it will cause a problem. However,
might come up at the neighborhood board meeting or whatever.
Yeah, board meeting, exactly.
Lena is composting shit, everyone. Okay, I'm sorry, go on.
No, that's completely fine. However, there is a way for gardeners like you to use other people's composted shit to grow your peppers. Because some wastewater treatment plants actually managed to make it work. In particular, the one in D.C. Converts the metabolic output of about 2.2 million people into a fertilizer, grade A, meaning completely safe, fertilizer called Bloom. It comes in this neat squared back with, big letters, Bloom. And it is the same, composted, sewage that is then squeezed to get all the water out and dried. And basically, when you open that back and you smell it, it's your classic garden dirt.
Wow. And that is made of the poop of people who live in D.C. Our politicians, our elected officials, their staff members, they're all pooping. And you can buy their poop and fertilize your garden with it.
Yes, you got it. You got it. Can you imagine that?
I mean, that's very beautiful because so much shit comes out of D.C. So, I finally made my way to the joke. that is so cool, though. Yeah, I'm looking at the website. You can just order it. Is there a reason there's nothing stopping me from doing that, from just purchasing?
Yeah.
From just purchasing there?
Yeah, wow. Completely.
Incredible. Well, look, I want to ask you more about our own relationship with shit and how we got here. I have some very specific questions for you, but we got to take a really quick break. We'll be right back with more Lena Zeldovich. Folks, today's sponsor is one I cannot recommend highly enough, Delete Me.
As a Factually listener, you know how much I value online privacy. Well, Delete Me has been an indispensable tool for me for many years. I've been using them long before they even started advertising on this show. This day and age, it is shockingly simple for data brokers to peddle your personal information without your consent. These data brokers may be selling your name, phone number, and home address, and you might never even know it's happening. Trying to locate and remove all this data yourself can feel like an impossible task, but that is where Delete Me shines. Their team of experts tirelessly scour the web to track down and wipe out your personal data. In just 7 days, you will receive a detailed report of their findings. And believe it or not, a whopping 41% of Americans are vulnerable to online harassment, from doxing to scams and even identity theft. In some cases, having your info online can turn cyberstalking into good old-fashioned in-person stalking. Protect yourself from these threats with Delete Me. So if you're like me and you value your personal privacy, you want to make sure that your identifying personal details are not floating around the internet where anybody can buy them, well, you can get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/Adam and use promo code Adam at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/Adam, code Adam. I wholeheartedly recommend this service. Check out Delete Me. Today's show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Our lives are super demanding these days. I know that I constantly catch myself wishing for extra hours in the day. But here's the thing. The problem isn't as simple as lack of time. It's that we often have trouble prioritizing what's actually important to us, whether that's seeing friends, talking to family, or even kicking back with a good book. This is one of the ways that therapy can be so valuable. Working with a professional can help you figure out your priorities and make time for the stuff that really matters. And therapy isn't just for big trauma. We can all use a little help, whether it's learning to deal with stress, setting boundaries, or just getting stuff off your chest. So if you're thinking about giving therapy a shot, you might check out BetterHelp. They say it's all online, super flexible, and fits right into your busy life. You just answer a few questions, and they say that they will hook you up with a licensed therapist. Plus, you can switch therapists at any time, no extra charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/factually today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/factually. Hey, everybody, I know we're in the ad break, but we're doing something a little bit different today. Today, I'm going to tell you about an amazing group of people who did not pay us anything to be a part of the show. We just think they do amazing work, and we wanted you to know about them. You might remember back in 2018, those heart-wrenching stories of families torn apart by Border Patrol, refugee children being pulled away from their parents who were in turn deported to their home countries. It was devastating then, and it's just as devastating now, with hundreds of families still not reunited after all these years. You know, we discuss so many problems on Factually, but I firmly believe that there is always something that can be done about those problems. And recently, I came across an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice. Since 2018, they have successfully brought together over 100 families torn apart by Trump's zero-tolerance policy. But reuniting those families is just the beginning. Al Otro Lado continues to support each family with legal aid, housing, and counseling to help heal and get back on their feet. I mean, can you imagine the agony of having your child ripped from your arms, unsure of when you'll see them again? We cannot allow such family separations to continue. So if you're like me and believe that all families belong together, then join me in supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today. You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website at alotrolado.org/volunteer. Thank you so much.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
So we're back with Lena Zeldovich. You know, something that always stuck with me was in our very first year in our writer's room in Adam Ruins Everything, we talked about, we did an episode that was about the sewer system of London and its creation and what a great public health, achievement that was. But one thing, one of our writers, Melinda Taub, wonderful writer, she said in our writer's room, this didn't make it into the episode, but she was like, isn't it weird that we transport shit from place to place using clean water? Isn't that strange? Like, literally, clean water, very precious resource. Here in Los Angeles, we are constantly having a drought, right? And yet, I am literally taking clean, drinkable water and dropping my, not only am I wasting my poop, right, and sending it far away rather than, you know, having it be used for fertilizer, I'm also transporting it using a precious clean substance. Like, that's, just think about it that way. Like, we could have gray water systems, right, things like that, that flush it using other forms of water. But just that weird discontinuity makes me think, okay, our relationship, our psychic relationship with this substance is really weird. And really messed up and is clearly stopping us from building something better. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's another kind of historically very complicated tangle of how we got there. Yeah.
How so?
Well, water is perhaps the only media that is so convenient. It exists in abundance, right? It rains, you get water. You can store it. You can direct it down through any type of pipes and it will, you know, wash away and carry through whatever is in those pipes. So even ancient societies, you know, build sort of, you know, more primitive set of, you know, pipes and toilets and sewage systems that operated on water because it was just so convenient. In some places, people build toilets over water. So that they, kind of like, you know, imagine an outhouse that doesn't have a pit, but instead it all falls into the water and floats away.
Yeah. Like, oh, like literally an outhouse, like over a river or something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly. Yeah. You can actually Google and find some hilarious, you know, pictures of toilets like that. It's pretty wild.
Yeah.
And so this is what we stuck with. And then the Romans perfected it with their Cloaca Maxima. They built this huge sewers. You know, you could go, you know, a horse-drawn carriage could go through them. Today, I think a car can drive through some of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's what the Romans did. And that's basically how we started to look at, you know, at our shit. Just, like, get rid of it. Like, who wants it?
But the mixture of it with the clean water system, right, also led to, like, if you're using water to transport your shit and you are using, you know, pre-modern sewage systems, pre-modern infrastructure, you're going to end up in situations where people are going to end up drinking, like, you know, contaminated water because you have now, in so doing, if you put your outhouse over your river and someone downstream is drinking from the same river, they're going to get sick. And so you are turning something clean that you need into something like kind of polluted. And you are also, as you say, polluting the ecosystem and things like that. It just seems like a very strange mixture, you know?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, that's, like I said, that's what we kind of inherited, and in a lot of ways from Victorian London, when they had this, you know, the great stink of London, which happened more than once, there were a lot of conversations about how to do this better. For example, you know, I call them sewage separatists. There was a group of people that suggested that there should be two separate systems, one for stormwater, basically clean water that would flow into the river and people could, you know, draw from that water, you know, to cook food and whatnot, and a separate system specifically for sewage. And that would be pumped out of the city and onto the farms that at the time weren't as far as they're now here in New York or in London. So maybe this would be doable. The questions that they couldn't solve were cost. Two systems instead of one. Two, how would shit move down through the pipes? You needed, at the time, all they had was steam. So you had to use water anyway. And that system could also clog. So you needed more water. So you couldn't, they couldn't get out of that water equation.
Yeah.
So we still have that water. There are better technologies these days that manage to sort of, you know, squeeze the water out of the sewage that comes out of a building, that gray water. It can be reused again, not for drinking, but for, you know, watering gardens, washing clothes, I am told, and other in other means, and they could recover. There's certain systems that could recover up to 98% of that water, from what I read. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there are. I looked into it once. There's gray. You could, if you want to replumb your house, you could get a gray water system installed in your house where it takes some of the excess water from maybe your laundry or something like that, your dishwasher, whatever, and then uses that to flush your toilet or to water your plants. There's also, you could also get rainwater capture and things like that. But it's like expensive, and a lot of plumbers don't like it because it like violates the rule that like water comes in one way and goes out the other way, and you shouldn't mix the two because they're worried about you getting shit in your drinking water. But it's like just, it's just sort of astonishingly rare. And so it just makes me think again, what you're describing here is like a fundamental inefficiency in the way that we have plumbed our entire civilization, that, that, you know, we talk about our civilization as being very efficient. Capitalism is being very efficient, but here is something where we are wasting a valuable resource, and we are, and we're not only wasting a valuable resource, we're using a precious resource, water, to waste the valuable resource. It's like,
you got
very
it.
Strange.
Yeah, no, you got it. You got it. I think in the past, you know, maybe 10 years or so, I've started noticing a change in that. It began around the time in 2011 when the Gates Foundation issued this, you know, Reinvent the Toilet Challenge. It was originally issued to create, my understanding is, it was issued to create better sanitation solutions in the developing world where it's really ugly. You know, people still head out into the bush. But out of that evolved different technologies that are quite applicable to our own world to stop using precious resource to, you know, wash down the valuable resource. And some of them might still sort of be in the early stages, but I know there is a company called Epic Clean Tech on the West Coast that developed that sort of like a plug-in. I don't think it works for houses per se, but it does work for buildings. They basically plug in this, you know, cartridge, for the lack of a better word, into the building's sewage pipes, and they stop it, you know, right there. Mm. They extract the water, and whatever's left of the poo eventually becomes fertilizer through their own, you know, proprietary method.
So that's cool.
Yeah. I like to say I see the sewage tide turning.
Wait, it sounds very ominous when you put it that way. But I did want to ask, because you mentioned places where, you know, they don't have access to adequate sewage, to safe sewage, where, you know, the human waste still gets people sick. And that's in fact something else we talked about in that very early episode of Adam Ruins Everything, that, you know, a lot of places don't have access to safe toilets, and, you know, also the sort of like habitual ways that excrement are dealt with there are not only inefficient, but very unsafe. And so I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, like how much of the world is affected by those issues. And if we're thinking about how we can redesign our sewage system so that we're not wasting this wonderful resource, right? In places like that, that need, you know, more infrastructure, is there a better sort of infrastructure that could be built than what we have here in, you know, Los Angeles or New York City?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the numbers of people who still don't have, you know, a safe and working toilets kind of, you know, fluctuate depending on exactly what statistic you look at. But it's still kind of in billions. It could be like 1.2 or near 2 billion, whatever, depending on exactly how they count. And a lot of people still head out into the bush, which is dangerous on its own. You know, heading out into the bush in some of these places in the middle of the night to take a leak, you don't know what's going to bite you or eat you.
Yeah.
So the other issue is that in a lot of these places, our Western flushing toilets can't be built, just can't be built, because the water is too unreliable. There's either too little water or there's too much. When it's too much, everything's going to spill. Like, we have sewage spills here all the time. There, it's just not going to work day one.
Yeah.
Because some of these places flood. For, you know, one place where I, you know, went to when I was reporting on the book was Madagascar. And then in its capital, people grow rice in their front yards. It's rice patches because it floods all the time. Like, this water just standing there. What are you going to do with it? how are you going to handle that? So most people just have latrines. But when it rains for 5 days, latrines overflow and all the stuff just floats out into people's yards and homes.
Yeah. And into their water, into their drinking water.
Like, yeah, completely. So it doesn't work. It needs a completely different solution. And there are startups in those parts of the world that are trying something completely different. They call it container-based sanitation. In short, what happens is, you know, they build toilets that are comfortable to sit on, but they're not connected to any pipes. There is like either a hygienic bucket or a biodegradable bag underneath. And once it's full, a service comes and swipes it for an empty one or a clean one. So it is basically manual waste collection, just like that manual waste collection that I described earlier in Japan. That output is taken then to a local, you know, waste treatment plant where it's loaded up into digesters and, you know, out comes fertilizer. And in that particular case, biogas, it's also a product of fermenting shit that you can use as energy. People cook with it. People boil water with it and whatnot. So this, you know, so it's based on containers. Hence the container-based sanitation. And it's a different way of doing it, but in a lot of ways, it's also more ecologically savvy. It doesn't waste water, and it returns poo to Mother Nature, to soil.
And I can imagine, a very mature, you know, high-tech version of this, right? I can imagine in LA, if I had some sort of toilet that had a container that I pooed in, right? And that sealed up nicely. And then, you know, I mean, look, I'm used to having a garbage man come take my garbage away, right? I take it out to the curb and they pick it up and they go do whatever with it. And I have my yard waste that is turned into, you know, mulch for the city parks department. And I've got, that I put my, dried leaves in, whatever, you know, yard trimmings. And I've got recycling. And so like, why not have a like shit pickup, right? I could imagine a version of that where, oh yeah, that's very much like my normal life, not any grosser, but I'm not using water to move the poo around and it is being used for something more productive. And I can imagine how, yeah, in a lot of places where maybe plumbing with water to move people's shit around is not the most effective for the reasons that you're saying, like that would be a good solution. Is that a model that you think is going to take off or is it just getting started?
So I think it's getting started in the developing world because it's a lot easier and a lot cheaper than laying down pipes that may or may not work. Here in this, in the Western world, I don't know. I could totally see it. The way I sometimes envision it is that you have this cartridge that pops underneath your toilet. And then there's a little flushing thing, say, I'm full. And then you swipe it. And yes, it goes out just with the rest of your garbage.
Yeah.
It could be, I mean, it's 21st century. We can make them so that they don't stink, that they, you know, flush at you, you know, it's almost full. It doesn't have to smell. Can be easy. I think all in all, it's doable. The issue is, I think, you're breaking through the human aversion of their metabolic output and creating these new infrastructures.
Right.
That's money.
But if you're, it costs money, but if you're doing that in a place where the infrastructure is needed anyway, there's perhaps a lower barrier to that.
Yeah.
And hey, you know, in the US, we are getting more open-minded about our shit. I mean, bidets are now taking America by storm. And everybody thought that we would never be into bidets and that we couldn't handle it because we're too prudish. And now everyone's getting one of these, a Toto or whatever it is installed.
Toto's,
it's like
yeah.
people's pride and joy. I want to make sure we talk about this and actually wish we had gotten into it a little bit earlier because I'm really fascinated by it. What about the medical potential of shit? This is like people are using each other's poop for therapy to cure diseases now, aren't they?
Yeah, that's, I would say it's a, you know, butting therapy, but in a lot of ways it's proven, definitely
it's
proven
a butting
it
therapy.
Butting therapy, exactly. I'd say in the past decade, or maybe two, medics fully recognized that human intestines is not just, you know, a place where your food sits and gets absorbed. It is actually a very thriving, rich ecosystem full of all kinds of microbes, mostly good that we need, but occasionally pathogens. And so sometimes, you know, some particularly bad antibiotic-resistant pathogens manage to settle there. People tend to get them after, like, a surgery in the hospital. One of these really bad bugs is Clostridium difficile. And I first wrote about it, I think, like, in 2013 or 2014, before I started working on the book. And in that story, which then also made it into the book, a lady in her 50s, you know, got this bug and couldn't shake it off. And about 25 or 35,000 people die from it because nothing works. At least back then, nothing was working. Antibiotics of last resort weren't working. It kept coming back. And she literally had, she tried everything. Somebody in her family Googled and found this, you know, procedure for fecal transplant that basically, basically boils down to you take the poop out of healthy individuals, mush it up, and put it into an enema and give it to the person who is suffering from this bug.
Yeah.
And you hope it works. And lo and behold, not only it worked, but it worked completely miraculously, better than any antibiotics she took before. Within a day, like in 24 hours, she was a completely changed person. She couldn't get up, and all of a sudden she had all this energy, and she was walking around and even willing to drive a car. Because what happened, she didn't just get the poop. She got all the microbes her body didn't have after all these antibiotics. And suddenly she had them all, and they were working, and they were producing all the necessary nutrients, and she was back to normal. And so she started this foundation called Fecal Transplant Foundation to educate other people about the method. And not only she did that, a year or two later, she convinced the FDA to let this method live, quote unquote. The FDA was very leery of it. It didn't want doctors to do it. It was afraid, you know, for people to do it. And think about it. It's completely against the logic that we were taught, right? So they were going to sort of like close it
poop
down.
Poop comes out of your butt. It doesn't go back up your butt. Like, it can't be good for you to put poop up your butt. It violates the sort of root notion we have about, and this is, these are some of the deepest down prejudices and ideas that we have. We learn this stuff very early. There's a lot of like weird religion in it about like it's sinful to poop. And so just this very idea of taking someone else's poop and putting it up your butt is strikes some people as like deeply wrong in a way that maybe they can't even articulate.
Diabolic. Heresy. Yeah, exactly. So she convinced them to let their idea live. And right now we have, there is this, you know, it's not even a startup anymore, in Boston called Open Biome that screens healthy donors for their poop and, you know, gathers that poop and stores that poop in freezers specifically for people who need it to battle that infection.
Wait, so can I, like, is this one of those things where I can send them a poop sample and they'll like keep it on file or something like that in case someone needs my poop?
No, not quite. You'd have to go there and get screened, man. They take your blood samples and poop samples and all kinds of things, and to make sure you qualify to donate. And what they told me is that it's easier to get into Harvard and MIT than pass their test.
But see, now I want to do it because I love signing up to donate body parts. I'm signed up as a body donor at UCLA. If I die, you know, the medical students will get to dissect me. I signed up for bone marrow transplants via an organization called, I think, Be the Match, where you just send them a little cheek swab. And then it's a very small chance, but if you're a match for someone's bone marrow, you might be asked to give a bone marrow transplant. And so I like, you know, having my body parts be useful to other people. I like being in the database. So maybe it says in Massachusetts, maybe I'll stop by and take the poop test.
It's near Boston.
But so this is my understanding is that, you know, we're still learning a lot about the gut biome, all the different microbes and what they do. But there's a whole lot of you know, conditions that can be caused by having the wrong kind of biome down there. Like things that are surprising that we might not even expect.
True.
You know, weight loss, weight gain, you know, IBS, certainly, all kinds of different disorders. And maybe the cure for some of these things is like inside of our friends and neighbors' asses.
It could be. We just don't know yet. Let me tell you this. Nobody looked. Nobody looked up close.
but this is like a brand new therapy, and it really is bringing like a lot of comfort to people. A lot of
yes. It's at the moment it's only used when everything else fails, and for that specific infection. There's a lot of conversation and research on how to expand it, but it's not quite there yet, because just like you said, you may inherit good bacteria, also may inherit bad bacteria. So if the question is, are you going to live or die, then maybe you not care so much whether you might inherit some diabetes from this transplant or not. It's all part of your metabolism, yeah. Right? So it's a very hot area of research.
Yeah.
And hopefully in the next decade, some more facts come out and we'll know more. Yeah.
And this is the really interesting thing about it being such a new area, because we still don't understand what so many of those microbes do. And so a lot of times I always like to caution people when we're talking about gut flora, gut biome stuff, that there's a lot of products out there that'll say, oh, this nurtures good bacteria or bad bacteria, like sort of quasi pharmaceutical products. And you got to be really careful with those, because the truth is that like we don't even understand enough about that yet to really be like taking supplements that are going to do XYZ. Anyone who like makes those claims is like a little bit suspect. But yeah, if lives have been saved through the first forms of this therapy that we have, through poop transplants, which by the way is very fun to say, poop transplant. I love it.
Yeah.
Incredible. I mean, do you have any opinion about like probiotics, things like that? Like, are these things that work, or are these things to be skeptical of?
Both. Yeah. I think some of them work, and I think some of them don't work at all.
Yeah.
And how to find out those that works? That's why FDA doesn't regulate them, because it has no clue how to regulate them. Because again, there's not enough science.
Yet, exactly.
I think a lot of these therapies work on some people and don't work on others, and a lot of it is just basically trial and error.
Mm.
Yeah, people do it themselves.
Well, so wait, people do it themselves? We'll just do the transplant themselves? Is that what you said?
Well, in the earlier days, that's what people did, because doctors wouldn't do it.
Mm.
So the lady that I described in my book, her husband was her donor. And on the morning of the transplant, he pooped into a little device that he like put on top of the toilet, and he took it, mixed it with that enema solution, put it in the blender, pushed the button, the whole thing kind of like whipped into a brown milkshake.
Oh.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you need a really strong stomach for all this stuff. So that's what it was. Yes, they did it completely themselves. I don't know if people still do it themselves, because now you actually can do it as an experimental therapy in a doctor's office.
I'm sure there are people out there there's a lot of people do weird things to their bodies, and I'm sure there are people out there, and I wouldn't advise that people do it themselves.
Yeah,
but
don't do it at all.
But this is how it got started, was through this.
Yeah.
I mean, so to bring us in for a landing here, like we've talked about how this is a part of our bodies that we often would rather not think about, even while I am pooping, I'm usually on my phone reading Twitter. I'm not thinking about what I'm doing, I'm trying to be far, far away from it. I'm doing a crossword puzzle. I'm doing the Wordle. I'm not thinking about what's coming out of my butt. I look back, I glance at it. I'm like, all right, good job. I hit flush and that's it, but you're talking about how, hey, the way that we deal with our poop causes environmental destruction in many ways. When it ends up creating algal blooms, stuff like that, and how we're wasting all this wonderful resource, the medical potential of it. After writing this book, what is your perspective holistically on what our relationship with poop could be if we were to take all this into account? And how do you suggest that folks at home, think about poop differently in their day-to-day lives as a result of all these insights.
It's like, it's one of my favorite topics. So when I...
People, it must be great. You're at a dinner party and people are like, what do you do for a living? And you're like, oh, well, I know a lot about shit. Let me tell you.
I advocate for poo.
I love it. I advocate for it.
Yeah, I advocate for poo. So we think of it. We think about poo as waste. Well, it's not true. It's not correct. We produce an extremely valuable metabolic product that our planet needs very badly to keep feeding us. Our farm fields need it very badly to bear crops. And if you think about it, it's such an incredible power that you carry within. You know, think about it. I call it people's own organic power. Poop.
I love it.
We're all super poopers. We just haven't been conditioned to think about it that way. But we all produce at least a pound worth a day of an incredibly versatile resource that can generate energy, become fertilizer, can be converted to crude oil or biogas. By using it properly, you can stave off algae blooms, you can stop over-fertilizing the ocean. By putting it back in the fields, you would also cut down on the, on the synthetic fertilizer that is polluting and contributes to acid rains and whatnot. Just think how you can fix all these problems with what you flush down the toilet. You know, be proud of that power within you, and you'll never flush the same way again.
You're incredible. Your body is a marvelous machine, and it's turning food not just into energy for you, but into something that has value, that is not useless, that has people's own organic power. I love that so much. Lena Zeldovich, thank you so much for coming on the show. The name of the book is?
The Other Dark Matter, The Science and Business of Turning Waste into Wealth and Health.
And of course, you can get it at our special bookshop, factuallypod.com/books. That's factuallypod.com/books. Lena Zeldovich, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a delight.
It's been a delight, too.
Well, thank you so much to Lena Zeldovich for coming on the show. I hope you loved that conversation as much as I did. If you did, please, again, consider supporting us on Patreon. Just head to patreon.com/Adam Conover. And of course, I want to thank all of our $15 a month patrons for supporting the show. That's Adam Simon, Allison Liberato, Alan Liska, Antonio LB, Aurelio Jimenez, Charles Anderson, Chris Dale, Drill Bill M, Hillary Wolken, Kelly Casey, Mark Long, Michael Warnicki, Michelle Glittermum, Paul Mauk, Rachel Nieto, Robin Madison, and Spencer Campbell. I want to thank our producer, Sam Roudman, our engineer, Ryan Connor, Andrew WK for our theme song, the fine folks at Falcon Northwest for building the incredible custom gaming PC that I'm recording this very episode for you on. You can find me online at Adam Conover, wherever you get your social media, or at adamconover.net. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time on Factually.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.